It is Friday, April the 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, ceasefire in Syria, but violence continuing.
It's really on this knife edge where violence is increasing in some areas. Some of it directed at, for example, Islamic State or a Nusra Front, which were excluded from the process.
Also ahead, reaction to deadly attacks in Burundi, choosing the next U.S. president, plus the latest on the aftermath of Prince's death.
We cannot.
Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The UN envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, is calling on the United States and Russia to intervene at the highest levels to salvage the two-month-old cessation of hostilities in Syria that he describes as barely alive. De Mistura, who has presided over the now stalled proximity talks between the government and opposition, those talks in Geneva, said the uptick in violence cannot be ignored.
We cannot ignore that, and we have not ignored it. We cannot ignore the fact that during these talks, we have been having incidents one after the other. In the last 48 hours, we have had an average of one Syrian killed every 25 minutes, one Syrian wounded every 13 minutes. But what we need to do and to hear is that the cessation of hostilities is salvaged, and that the cessation of hostilities is saved from a total collapse. It's still there, because many areas is still there, but is in great danger.
Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales in Australia tells VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype de Mistura has some leverage given the backing of his efforts by both the U.S. and Russian governments.
To a point, there has been some progress. There has been a diminution of the violence. There has been some humanitarian aid getting through to various communities, etc. But it's really on this knife edge where violence is increasing in some areas. Some of it directed at, for example, Islamic State or a Nusra Front, which were excluded from the process. But some of it seems to be, in the North Aleppo area, for example, seems to be still directed at some of the less fundamentalist groups. His problem is that there's no real opposition. There are people who have attended the conferences in Europe who are put forward as secular groups, as friends of the West, if you like. But their capacity, their influence is limited. So he's working with a very weak foundation, if you like. I think the real danger for him is that the Russians and the Americans are going to start pushing their allies, their two sort of sets of allies, if you like, in the region, to increase the violence. So we've heard Obama say that he's going to be sending more troops to the region. The Russians seem to have increase the level of violence, their level of activity in the region. So there's this point at which the Americans and the Russians in particular need to somehow or other listen to Mistura and say, okay, we'll just ease off here.
The reports keep mounting about a military buildup in northern Syria, coupled with heavy fighting, with mounting civilian casualties. The Associated Press reporting some 200 civilians killed in just the past week, nearly half of them around Aleppo, where there's been shelling and airstrikes. What is this fighting all about?
Aleppo is a central issue in this conflict. The government wants to retake or at least have Aleppo at its mercy, I think. There's also the issue there that despite some reasonable gains, I suppose, on the part of some of the rebel forces, the government, I think, has been led to, especially after Palmyra, has been led to think that it's winning. And if you're winning, why should you bother negotiating with these people who, after all, have no real standing? And so I think this is really important for the Russians to come in and say, well, okay, we've saved your bacon. We're going to ensure that you continue, but you've got to give a little bit.
Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales in Australia speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he's outraged by an airstrike on a Syrian children's hospital in Aleppo, directly blaming President Bashar al-Assad's forces. The strike destroyed the hospital, which was supported by Doctors Without Borders. At least 20 children and doctors were killed, including the last pediatrician working in rebel-controlled areas of Aleppo. Secretary Kerry also had the opportunity on Thursday to speak to some young people. One of them asked him what the toughest part of his job might be.
The hardest thing of all, honestly, the hardest thing of all as Secretary is just the large number of immediate challenges that come across the desk, which require United States engagement, involvement to try to prevent people from dying, people from being killed, prevent conflict. We have explosions in enough places in the world, more so than any administration, I think, in history, have never had to deal with a Korea that's threatening with nuclear weapons, or the problems of Yemen where there's a war, or Libya where Al-Qaeda and Daesh, ISIL, are there and presenting a challenge, and there's a lack of government, or Syria where there's a terrible war going on, a civil war, sending countless refugees out of their homes and across borders into other countries. So you pile those up over time, and take a number of countries in Africa, a number of countries in South Central Asia, a number of countries in the Middle East, and so forth. You have more than enough to fill the plate. And that's the hardest thing of all, is marshaling our resources and our diplomatic energy to be able to try to deal with all of those things at the same time.
That is U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Still ahead, another missile launch by North Korea.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
North Korea has apparently test-fired an intermediate-range missile that crashed seconds after takeoff in what appears to be the second such failure in a matter of weeks. The launch comes as South Korea and the United States conduct annual joint military drills that North Korea has labeled a provocation. Brian Padden is VOA's correspondent in Seoul and tells International Edition Susan Yaki the launch is drawing more criticism against North Korea.
The international community is quite united in opposing North Korea's efforts to acquire advanced nuclear weapons capability. Since January, after North Korea conducted its fifth nuclear test, as we all know, the United Nations imposed tough new sanctions on the Kim Jong-un government, and those sanctions could get even stronger or more strongly enforced or more sanctions approved if North Korea continues with these types of provocations, and most specifically, if it conducts a fifth nuclear test, which South Korean authorities say it is the North is prepared to do any day now.
This comes right before a high-profile party meeting next week in Pyongyang. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, and this is part of the motivation we understand for all of these activities recently is kind of they are to enhance the image of the young Kim Jong-un, the young leader of North Korea, in advance of this rare party Congress meeting, the first time in 36 years that such a meeting is going to occur. Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, did not think highly of these official congresses and functions, and he did not have them during his time. So it is a change of legislative structure that Kim Jong-un wants to rebuild the party apparatus wants to be seen as a head, wants to have that stature as head of the party in this conference to legitimize perhaps his own rule. What we are standing by to learn is that he will likely speak at this conference. We want to hear what he has to say. We'll be listening to see how exactly he responds to the sanctions in this speech, how he responds to the international community's calling for North Korea to give up its nuclear arsenal and come back to the bargaining table to talk about security assurances and economic aid in response for giving up those nuclear weapons.
VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden speaking with my colleague Susan Yockey. Staying on the subject of North Korea's missile tests, we turn now to International Edition social media expert G. Abby Lee, just to find out what's being said online about it all. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. I saw a lot of people making fun of the failure and referring to the missiles as candles on South Korea's internet portal site, Naver. I also went over to the Joseon Ilbo website, the daily's most popular conservative publication in the South. That being said, it's no surprise the most liked response to its article about the test reads like this. The pro-Pyongyang politicians and activists must be disappointed. Another person wrote, it looks like a historic decision-making time is near.
And you gotta say, the whole news is making headlines all over the world.
That's right. Al Jazeera English is one of the many media outlets reporting on it. On Facebook, it wrote, if confirmed, you'd be the second such failure in weeks. Other replies are also critical of the North nuclear program.
I saw that U.S. Republican presidential contender Donald Trump also expressed his opinion on North Korea, as well as U.S. foreign policy prior to the test.
He did. The right-leaning Fox News tweeted about it Wednesday. Quoting Trump, he tweeted, Obama watches helplessly as North Korea increases its aggression and expands nuclear reach. Replies to that tweet generally criticized Trump's statement as lacking evidence using hashtag NeverFacts.
And I suppose, G, before we leave our social media segment, we should move on a bit to U.S. domestic politics. Not a great day for presidential hopeful Ted Cruz, is it?
Well, depends on how you see it. Former House Speaker John Boehner called Cruz Lucifer in the flesh. That's a byword for the devil in the West. Boehner was speaking at the Stanford University in California. He was also quoted as saying this about the Texas senator. I get along with almost everyone, but I have never worked with a more miserable person in my life. Those words are not exactly friendly, but some pundits say that Boehner's support for Trump could actually give a boost to Ted Cruz's campaign. Back to you, Steve.
And many thanks to you, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. Later in the program, the U.S. presidential election and the part talk radio plays in it all. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Raad al-Hussein has condemned the increasing number of attacks against high-level officials in the country of Burundi. There are two such attacks just this week. Cecily Pouilly is the spokesperson for the UNHCR, and she speaks now from Geneva with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Well, we're obviously deeply concerned by this increasing number of targeted assassinations in Burundi. Many have been targeting high-level officials, including more recently the Brigadier General Kararuza, who was assassinated on Monday. There was also an attempt at assassination against the Minister of Human Rights the previous day on Sunday. So we are deeply worried because this seems to show that the situation in Burundi is going from bad to worse and is extremely dangerous and might well lead to more unrest.
Now, the situation started getting worse about a year ago once President Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. And then we started to see more and more violence. Are we seeing anyone claim credit for these attacks?
Well, you know, the situation started, as you say, about a year ago. There were lots of demonstrations, massive arrests, and we did report about worrying information about torture cases and so on. Now, there were the December attacks, really around mid-December, there were attacks against military camps, and after that, the situation really significantly deteriorated. Since then, what we see is that kind of a tit-for-tat situation where you have security forces heavily deployed in Bujumbura, in provinces, massive arrests, and when you also have rebel groups who are claiming responsibility for some of these attacks. However, one has to note that in many circumstances, these assassinations are carried out by unidentified armed men. And, you know, it's very hard to establish responsibility for some of these attacks. This is also why we've asked for proper investigations, because the perpetrators need to be arrested and they should be brought before the law.
How concerned is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights that this violence will get really out of control and become a regional problem?
Well, you know, we're already seeing the regional impact. You have a large number of refugees, over a quarter of a million people who fled the country. We have over 500 people killed since April 2015, massive cases of arrest. So it's a very worrying situation. And we've been warning over the last few months about the potential of destabilization on the entire region. So for sure, we are closely following up this situation, and we really do hope that the upcoming talks in Arusha, which, you know, is a very symbolic place since it's where the peace was negotiated after the civil war, you know, we really hope that all the parties will seize this opportunity to re-establish a meaningful dialogue. There is no other way around but finding a political solution to a political crisis and to improve the human rights situation on the ground.
As Cecily Pouilly, she's the spokesperson for the Human Rights Commissioner at the UN. She was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Hundreds of local conservative talk radio hosts across the U.S. are tapping into the electorate's outsider sentiments this election season, contributing to the rise of Republicans Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. VOA's Katherine Gibson visits the state of Pennsylvania to learn more about talk radio's impact.
A quiet Sunday morning in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, but not inside the radio booth where the Mark Scaringi Show tapes.
Well, and good morning and welcome to the Mark Scaringi Show on WHYL 960 AM Carlisle.
He's a Donald Trump supporter and one of hundreds of local talk show hosts across the country talking about conservative values.
Terrorism, the immigration issue. Those have been probably the two biggest issues.
Scaringi says Trump addresses those issues with an America First approach, and he tries to do the same on his show.
I will try to tie it back to the Constitution, and we'll try to answer those debates and those dilemmas by how our founding fathers considered, deliberated, and then decided those issues.
Conservative talk radio provides a platform for voters to discuss the issues they feel are not addressed by mainstream media, corporate interests, and the Republican establishment.
Well, they're probably trying to downplay the overwhelming popular support that Donald Trump has.
I think there's a very different conversation happening here locally. I think you're hearing it on shows like Mark's.
Zimmerman, a self-described Trump supporter, says he listens to the show because of Scaringi's balanced approach.
He does have an open mind. And he's listening to what people are saying, certainly his callers in his show, and they're voicing themselves, and they're angry.
That host-listener relationship is key, says researcher Brian Rosenwald, who is writing a book about the impact of conservative talk radio.
Talk radio hosts can say what a lot of average Joes are thinking, but feel like they can't say.
Talk radio's influence has chipped away at the Republican establishment, influencing local elections across the country and mobilizing to help give Ted Cruz a primary win in Wisconsin over Donald Trump.
Is if the establishment tries to pick a nominee who is not Ted Cruz or Donald Trump in July in Cleveland, talk radio is absolutely going to explode.
Listeners will be able to follow along when Scaringe serves as a convention delegate for Trump. In Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
You can keep up to date on the U.S. presidential race at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Thanks to technological advances in crop nutrition and improved education in soil management, the farming industry in Kenya is becoming a financially lucrative profession for young people. In fact, Anthony Manune returned home from America to run a farm on a half acre of land leased from the Kenya Institute.
I have sat down and really reviewed my business plan so that I can work for profit.
Locally sourced produce might find its way into restaurants like the Mercantile Cafe, where manager Seth Johnson says he buys from local farmers for the quality.
We know the farmers. We know that that they've picked it that morning and that they've brought it directly to us.
Three-fourths of Kenyans are under the age of 34, and while older farmers have been reluctant to adapt to the new technology, younger farmers like Manune are excited about their prospects in the agricultural field, expecting more satisfaction and profit from their crops. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. You know, a week has passed now since music icon Prince died at his home near the U.S. city of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And now some information has begun to trickle out about his death, plus more. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald about it all.
The world still mourns the loss of Prince, but we have learned a few things about him, and one of the interesting things is he did not leave a will, but he left an awful lot of stuff.
He sure did. Hey, Jim, this is partly owing to his deep-seated distrust of contracts. He had terrible experiences with record labels. He famously wrote the word slave on his cheek in the 1990s when he was battling with Warner Brothers Records. Now, on Tuesday, his sister Tyka Nelson filed an emergency motion to have an administrator gather and protect Prince's assets. Bremer Bank has been appointed to fill that role. Prince was married twice, and he and his wife Maytay suffered some miscarriages. But as far as we know, he does not have any surviving children. Now, the trust also needs to locate Prince's heirs, and as of now, they include Tyka and five half-siblings. Lawyers who handle intellectual property say it may take years to determine the value of Prince's estate, and we, the public, may never hear about it. Right now, it's estimated to be worth well in excess of $100 million. People have thrown various figures around, up to and including $300 million. Prince worked with many lawyers, accountants, and business managers over the years, and this just further complicates the process. He would apparently drop them at the slightest pretext and then have somebody else sign up. So there are a lot of channels that this has to go through.
It's really fascinating. The songs in the vault, we understand there are quite a few, and we could end up, once they get this sorted out, with Prince albums coming out for years to come.
It may well be a Jimi Hendrix-type situation where there were several posthumous albums issued. He was very prolific. He released 39 albums over the course of his 38-year recording career, and apparently he has hundreds more songs in the vaults. And so their worth will depend on when and how they're released. That's the latest on Prince's estate situation. Meanwhile, a law enforcement official told CNN that authorities found prescription opioid medication in Prince's possession and at his home. They want to determine who prescribed the pills and if they were improperly prescribed. Entertainment Tonight is reporting that Prince used the pain medication Percocet to treat hip and ankle pain beginning in 2006. He underwent hip replacement surgery in 2010. Prince was 5 feet 2 inches, and he frequently wore high-heeled shoes. And his former fiancée and musical collaborator Sheila E. remarked that he was in constant pain because he would often jump from stage risers during his concerts. And this put tremendous pressure on his ankles and hips. And so apparently Prince lived his later years in constant pain, and that must have been just horrible.
Always with us is Ray McDonald, our Top 20 Countdown host. You can follow him on Twitter at Ray on the Hits. And Ray, they can join you every week for the Countdown at
VOA1.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, it turns out that an official Whitney Houston documentary is in the works from Oscar-winning filmmaker Kevin MacDonald. It will be the first to be authorized by the late pop star's estate, that is. She died back in 2012, you'll remember. She was 48. MacDonald has won an Academy Award for his Munich Olympics documentary One Day in September. He said he wants to tell the story of how brilliant an artist Houston was and how she changed the way pop music was sung. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. We hope you'll stay tuned for the latest world news. It's coming up next. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the release of the State Department's annual country reports on human rights, which document human rights conditions in 177 countries, including Iran, Assistant Secretary of State of the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Tom Malinowski, noted that the reports come at a time when authoritarian governments are striking out with particular ferocity against the freedoms of expression, association, and the press. The report on Iran notes severe restrictions on civil liberties, including the freedoms of assembly, association, speech, including via the internet, religion, and press. It also cites limitations on citizens' ability to choose their government through free and fair elections, abuse of due process with escalating use of capital punishment for crimes that do not meet international minimum standards of most serious crimes, arbitrary detention, politically motivated violence and repression, harsh prison conditions, discrimination against women, ethnic and religious minorities, as well as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex persons. The human rights reports contain numerous examples of rights abuses from around the world. In Iran, they include the case of labor activist Shahrokh Zamani, who died in custody in Rajai Shahr prison, of the deteriorating medical condition of journalist and human rights activist Narges Mohammadi, who has been charged with propaganda against the state and assembly and collusion against national security, of the forced virginity test of imprisoned cartoonist and activist Atina Farag Dhani, originally sentenced to 12 years for such crimes as spreading propaganda and insulting members of parliament. In an interview with the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that when President Hassan Rouhani was elected, the Iranian people had high expectations because of his promises to improve human rights and the rule of law. Unfortunately, we have not seen significant changes, said Mr. Malinowski.
One constant through this is that the Iranian people want to live in a more normal country. They have said that to their own government and to the international community every chance that they have had.
Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that the nuclear agreement between the P5 plus one countries and Iran has raised hopes for greater normality in the future. But true normality is only going to come, he said, if the Iranian government rights its relationship with its own people through respect for law, respect for human rights, respect for those international norms which are important in Iran and everywhere in the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. It's